few dates in the Midwest, Traverse City, Michigan, Worthington, Minnesota. At the last couple of shows, several people came up to me to talk about my book about Dad. It's been almost 30 years since it was published, but it really strikes a nerve with some people. When Dear Dad came out, I received more than 10,000 letters. Letters that were really emotional, sometimes heartbreaking, from readers who felt that they were reading their own story and my struggle to understand a difficult, frequently cruel alcoholic parent. One letter writer actually visited Dad's gravesite at Fort Snelling National Cemetery, just like I did at the end of the book. "I hope you don't mind," the person wrote. "I felt very close to you and your family after reading the book." Mind? How could I mind? It was a beautiful sentiment. It's comforting to find others like me. Alcoholism is a silent assassin that keeps attacking long after the attacker is dead and gone. We keep feeling it, forever. Trauma is trauma, Mama. And I thank you for standing in front of the blast time and time again. Another letter writer wrote that, in the same way Dad was with us, his father never told me anything at all about his childhood, and I thought that odd. People from that generation were different. Their lives were different. The world was also different. That's true. Dad's unwillingness to share moments from his terrible childhood, a lot of that could have as much to do with generational style as with who he was or what he suffered. Or maybe it comes down to a really simple idea. Who wants to revisit the scene of a crime? Who wants to revisit what they had felt they laid to rest? Well, you know, Mom, it's always right there, the source of the pain. It's right there within reach. You have to stare it down, back it into a corner, say, "You have no power over me," until the monster is no longer a monster. It's just a little pea in a pod, and that little pea can't affect you anymore. Only fear and anxiety allow the pea to grow into a boulder. Another letter writer, David, a self-described fat adult child of an alcoholic, wrote that, "Your life and mine have taken different paths, but the feelings you describe are the same as mine. I am tempted to send the book to my father. Maybe I will." I hope he did. On the other hand, a letter writer from Massachusetts wrote, "You're looking for answers, Louis, but there might not be any." If she's right, that'll be very frustrating. But she's probably right, right? Am I supposed to stop asking questions? One letter writer asked questions about his recently deceased alcoholic father I never asked of Dad, but now I'm obsessed with it. I could not help wondering. What was it like at the moment of his last heartbeat? What was his very last thought? Me too. Was Dad's last thought, "Hey, I'd love to have one more drink"? Was it, "I'm sorry"? Was it, "Ah, shit, that's it"? Maybe the last thought was relief from a lifelong fight with his own demons and dragons. His boulder, his mother and father, his father's father. Maybe it was memories of a childhood whose chance for happiness ended so abruptly. One 20-year-old woman with a double whammy, both parents were alcoholics, wrote me, "The big thing that I am not getting over is the guilt and self-esteem thing. I can't think of myself as worthwhile, although I'm ready to. I have had enough of this life." This woman has a baby son. She sells shoes at Sears in a mall. She struggled with food and weight issues, too. Bulimic for years. Her husband is a recovering alcoholic. Her father is in denial about alcoholism. Yet she writes me things like, "I really want to tell you about my husband's relapse. It's the kind of morbid, funny humor you might like. And I've been in treatment and everything. It's all really laughable." Isn't that remarkable, Mom? How can people still do that after so much pain? I think part of us becomes addicted to the dread, the drama, the disrespect. We crave it. We need it. We search for it in others and in ourselves. But there's a switch that you have to learn how to turn off, a discomfort switch. At least I know I'm no good. At least I know they're going to hate me. At least things are not going to work out. That switch has to be turned off. Sometimes we need to just find an actual switch in the house and turn it off. Any switch. Just find one. Turn it off and say, I'm worth it. 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 I just want to make a point here. I'm worth it. 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 You may have to say it a few thousand times before we start to believe it. I'm worth it. Mom, I'm worth it. And so were you. Love, worth it, Louie. Life sucks without bread. Hey, Mom. Did you know Minnesota has the world's largest candy store? I thought I might get a chance to go there on this trip home, but it doesn't look like it. I've never been there, but I'm proud that Minnesota's largest candy store in Jordan, just south of Chaska, is supposedly the world's largest candy store. Mom, we also have the largest shopping mall in the country, the Mall of America. It opened in Bloomington 2 years after you died. It gets the same number of visitors every year as Disneyland, Disney World, Yellowstone, Yosemite combined. Ah! You would have been a regular, huh? I remember buying candy as a kid. I got money from you or Dad and went to the corner store by school and bought silver dollars, 2 for a penny. Red licorice in the shape of a half-dollar piece. Hard and delicious. I'd cram them into my mouth, systematically feed them in as if my mouth were a vending machine slot. And even when I got it full, I'd keep at it and usually jam the slot. And I would just keep chewing and chewing, slowly chewing. I remember my jaw would be so sore because I had to finish the candy before I got home or to school. Maybe I even drooled some in my lust to eat and finish. I've forgotten a lot of things from my childhood, but I remember that exact feeling. Is that food addiction? Probably. After all, I am a food addict. You know what's amazing? Even as I write this, I really can feel it in my jaw. The insatiable need for candy or really any food, that feeling that I shouldn't have. That feeling, oh my God, I have to have this. I will even steal money out of my dad's pants, dig for pennies, so I can get the candy. That was my first drug of choice, candy. There was a secret involved. There was shame involved. I was trying to hide it from others. What was going on with me, Mom? What exactly happened to me? Why was I somehow able to take that terrible drawback and cultivate it into a successful career as a comedian? Because that's what I did. I turned it all around. I turned it on its head. I used it against myself so that other people couldn't use it against me. I took charge of it, of the knowledge. I could dole out however much I wanted. I was the controller over myself. Wow, that's a little heartbreaking. At meals, I had to be careful about how much food I put on my plate because Dad was watching, and he might yell at me for how much I took. Lardass was his go-to insult. But you gotta have enough mashed potatoes so you can make an indentation deep enough for the gravy to pool. And you need the corn. And the pot roast, Mom, which you had been cooking for 300 or 400 hours. Wouldn't it be rude not to have seconds? When there are people in Africa and China way poorer than us who could never afford such a meal. Oh, and you have to take some more of that incredible, delicious gravy, which is meant for the pot roast anyway, so it wouldn't be right to just have pot roast without gravy. At Thanksgiving, you'd make 700 pounds of sweet potatoes, and then you'd ask periodically, "Did you have some sweet potatoes?" Of course I had, but whenever you asked that, how could I not take another helping? Especially when you said, they're hot, there's more in the oven, there's some in the garage. The last part I made up. And the hot buns, and the iceberg lettuce, which doubled as the healthy Anderson salad. And there was always dessert, and we had our own deep fryer. When we first got the deep fryer, I remember that we cut up every potato that we could find to make french fries. You have to. Then we got so sophisticated, we made potato chips all by hand. We didn't have any kind of slicer. We were the slicers and dicers. Then we took chicken to fry up, but we never really knew what we were doing with chicken. Or at least I didn't. We wanted to fry up anything. Onion rings, of course, and a whole can of white lard you use so often. Mom, I thought about throwing a potholder into the fryer just to see if it would crisp. Well, we all have our own drug, minus food. It was for you too, Mom, though maybe not quite as much. The few photographs I've seen of you as a child show a plump little girl, and only two of the 11 Anderson kids are or were what you could actually call thin. The other nine are or were anywhere from slightly overweight to obese to morbidly obese, like Mary and me. Tommy gets up there too, though he was fat in a different way, big boned, bigger skeleton than mine, built more like Dad. I'm built more like you, Mom. With a smaller skeleton, my fat all pools in the gut and thighs. In one way, food is a tougher drug to deal with than actual drugs. In some ways, not in other ways, for a lot of people it's still hard to believe that food is a drug. But just like other drugs, it affects us emotionally and physiologically. When I bite into a Carl's Jr. $6 burger, I have a physiological reaction to it, which then alters me emotionally. Maybe the high isn't as big as the high from cocaine, but it certainly changes how I feel. I'm okay now. I'm okay. I'm okay now. The other night I had some bread. Now, Mom, I'm trying not to eat bread these days, so that's got to be something of a surprise to you, but the restaurant had gluten-free bread, and I knew I could have that. Gluten-free bread has no wheat, and it's the wheat that really affects me. So I took some lean turkey, put it on gluten-free bread, bit into it, and I was like, oh, I get it. It's not just gluten-free, but taste-free, too. Oh, so disappointing. The only way to eat gluten-free bread is to toast it, butter it real good, and put jam on it, until you've eliminated the whole point of the gluten freedom. And here's why, in some ways, food's the hardest addiction. Food addicts can't completely avoid their weaknesses. We need food to live. Yes, I should eat healthy, organic, fresh, non-processed food, but I'm still always skirting disaster. You don't tell a crackhead they can go to the crack den, just don't have any crack. When I drive past McDonald's, am I supposed to pretend I don't see the golden arches? Pretend it's just a yellow statue of butt cheeks and move on? And how much steamed broccoli can one man eat? Jeez Louise! Steamed broccoli! Yeah, can I get the tasteless steamed broccoli, please? Sometimes it feels like the only thing I'm allowed to eat is steam. Eventually, I would like some cheddar cheese on my steam. I try to eat healthier, Mom, but I came from an unhealthy family, and I still feel as if healthy food has a way to go. How much are organic bananas? $2.99 a pound? And the non-organic bananas? They're free. Oh, give me the free bananas and some organic stickers, please. I have trouble with some of the other labeling, too, like free range. What does it mean? It means that instead of being cooped up before we kill them, the chickens get to run free before we kill them. But you know the cooped-up chickens are trying to warn the free-range chickens, sticking their heads up against the wire, calling out, "You're living a lie, Betty!" Actually, it's not food that's my drug. It's bread. Life really sucks without bread. It does. Growing up Anderson, it felt like if there's no bread, there's no meal. Here today, I was having a great day, Mom. I took care of myself. I exercised. I ate healthy, and then I went to meet some friends at a restaurant, and they brought us a loaf of really, really good Italian bread with an incredible crust. Oh, if I were put on a desert island, I would just want a giant baguette and a keg of butter. That sounds great, actually. I bet you think so, too, Mom. Remember how I used to joke about how my mom ate every piece of butter in the Midwest? Well, I had a dream the other night that I had died and I was taken to the funeral home and embalmed with butter. When they went to put me in the casket, it was a giant baguette. They slid me in, cut a hole in the top, and a breadstick was holding the top of the casket open. People walking by me, paying their respects and saying, "God, he smells good." One person even grabbed a hunk of the baguette casket as they walked out. The only problem is they left my shoes on. If you're going to slide me into a baguette casket, remove my shoes, please. Life sucks without bread. Warmly with butter, Louis. Louis Anderson is dead. Hey, Mom. When we finish filming season one of Baskets, I'm sure I'll feel a little let down. Hopefully we'll get renewed for a second season, but either way, I'm grateful for the experience. I try to appreciate every moment. You never know when you won't be able to anymore. I was dad once for a few hours. About 6 years ago, some jokers decided to pull a hoax that I had died. Not just me, but Britney Spears, Jeff Goldblum, Harrison Ford, George Clooney, Miley Cyrus, Natalie Portman, Ellen DeGeneres. We'd all died. The idea was to spread the news on the internet. What's the internet, Mom? Okay, it's basically the world now, the place where we spend most of our waking hours, even though it's not really real. Or it is real, but most of us don't know where it is. It's a place where you can do lots of things, including things you didn't even particularly want to do, and learn odd things like that you're dead when you're not. It's just like an actual world, Mom. Hard to explain. I can't remember the cause of my death, but allegedly Jeff fell from a 60-foot cliff while filming a movie in New Zealand. Harrison allegedly drowned in a capsized yacht in the Riviera, and George allegedly died in a private plane crash in Colorado. So I was dead, we were dead, to at least a bunch of strangers, until we started piping up that we weren't. I don't know how many people have to believe it's a hoax for it to be considered a success, but for a while, if you Googled Louis Anderson, maybe the fourth entry came up, Louis Anderson is dead. What's Google, Mom? You know when you couldn't remember some actor's name or the name of the shopping center with the Red Owl grocery store in it, and you'd call your friend Monty because she always knew all that stuff, or you could remember only the names of two of the ships that Columbus sailed, the Nina and the Pinta, but not the third? Well, imagine that there's a place that you can type in your question, and you don't even have to type them in a question form, just a few key words, and then suddenly, before you even can get your eyeglasses on, it's telling you that it was Robert Mitchum, Phelan Shopping Center, and Santa Maria. That's what Google is, 1,000 Monty's out there and more, millions of them. Google is the person in the neighborhood with all the information, like Monty, but also the nosiest person, kind of like Darlene. You remember Darlene, Mom, 3 doors down, always had her nose out the window. Because Google is not only answering your questions, but then it's getting inside your head to figure out what you might think of next before you think of it. Were you asking about sparkly shoes? Well, the next time you go to your computer, you'll see an ad to buy sparkly shoes. So it's sort of like Monty times a million plus Darlene, if Darlene were Big Brother. Anyway, when the hoax about my death turned out to be just a hoax, a lot of people on Twitter tweeted me, "Louis, I thought you were dead." And I would reply, "Hold on, let me check." I guess I can't be that mad at the hoaxers because I got a rare gift. The chance to experience what it's like to have people think you're dead, then realize, no, you're not. And then enjoy this outpouring of genuine feeling and relief with people calling or writing to say, "Oh, Louis, I'm so happy you're still alive." Me too. I like being dead for a while. Kind of like Tom and Huck standing in the back of the church listening to their own eulogies and the whole town weeping for them. This is Twitter, Mom. Imagine you're in a class and you write a note that says, "I like your new shoes," and you pass it to a friend, Ruthie, and Ruthie writes something on the note, but instead of passing it back to you, she passes it to someone else. And then it goes around the room and finally gets back to you, and your note not only says thank you from Ruthie, But it also has a lot of comments from classmates saying they love her shoes. Some say that they hate her shoes. And also some mean comments about you from classmates you really don't know that well. And while the comments are all signed, some of them have names that are clearly made up, like I'm an Idiot, or Robinson Crusoe III, or So Hungry. Mom, here's the thing about the internet. Google, Twitter, and a lot of other inventions that weren't around when you were, they're all versions of things that existed, only we added electricity to them, which in some ways made them better, in other ways ruined them. One nice thing about coming back to life is a lot of people got back in touch with me. Louis Anderson is not dead. I want to be with you, Mom. I really do. Just not yet. Still kicking. Louis. P.S. I'll write to you about the day you died for real. Just not yet, Mom. No Family Feud. Hey, Mom, if I didn't have you as a model, I wouldn't have had success playing the matriarch of a dysfunctional but ultimately loving TV family. I've been thinking about that and how art imitates life, and how my real family has influenced not only who I am, but my professional success, too. I mean, I do lots of material about my family. My TV cartoon Life with Louis was our family, barely disguised. I worked on another TV show, a sitcom, The Johnsons Are Home, also based on our family. Then there's Family Feud, the incredible popular game show that has family in the very title and turned out to be this weird, joyous thread throughout my life. Do you remember our watching Family Feud when I was still living at home? With you, Dad, Tommy was still there, too. And Tommy and I sat on the couch, or I sat on the arm of the couch, and maybe Tommy wasn't there, but upstairs in the bedroom, looking through my record albums. Anyway, Dad was there in his chair, and you were in the kitchen. And like every American family, we tried to guess the number one answer. And you would come out of the kitchen and occasionally throw your 2 cents in. Dad would complain about Richard Dawson slobbering all over the women when he kissed them. And I think Dad might have been a little jealous, really. About 25 years later, producers of Family Feud were looking for a new host. They wanted me to do a pilot, but I wouldn't. I knew if I shot a pilot afterward, they could say, no. And if they really wanted me, they'd put up the money to attract me, and they'd hire me for the job or not. So we didn't shoot a pilot, but the producers asked me if I'd go to London to host some episodes of Family Fortune, the British version of Family Feud. I went, and the contestants were American servicemen and servicewomen stationed over there, and the producers thought I was terrible. I probably was. Oh, well. But when I was back doing shows in Vegas, the producers asked if I would host an episode taping it with audience members on stage as a sales tool to show the show to station managers across the country. It so happened that we were having an Anderson family reunion in Vegas right around that time. And we could be the guests on both sides. So we did. I played host with both sides of my family, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews. And it was so much fun. And because I was so relaxed, the tape of that episode landed me the job as the new host. Though that wasn't even the point. Some of the people who care about me wondered why I would take the job. They said it would hurt my career. I said, well, let's see, my comedy's all about family. I did a cartoon about my family. Why wouldn't I do Family Feud? I'm glad I listened to myself. I wasn't afraid that I couldn't do this or that. I don't think it hurt my career. I think it helped it. I learned a great deal doing it, and those were three of the most fun years of my life, from 1999 through 2001. I wish you could have seen it, Mom. I hope you did. You would have been calling the answers out at the TV, with your second youngest child just on the other side of the screen to tell you and everyone else what the survey said. I love game shows, and they're part of America. I like to think we invented them, but I have no idea if we did. We shot 5 shows a day and filmed on 36 days, so in a little more than a month's worth of shooting, we completed 180 shows. A year's worth. Each show runs twice, of course. First we did it at CBS, the same studio where they filmed The Price is Right, and then moved to NBC where they filmed Tonight Show. How great is that? The ratings for the show reversed their downward trend. They doubled, in fact. Then, somewhere along the way, I got really full of myself. I wish I would have worked harder at that point in my career and been nicer. The show's success made me think it would just go and go and go. But that's not how life happens, I learned. I acted like a big shot. People kept telling me how great I was. And guess what? I believed them. I sometimes acted rude and mean, like a prima donna. I could be difficult. I hurt people. I regret that. I hurt myself, too. I tripped on myself, Mom. I didn't even see it. And so life and success didn't just go and go and go. It was go and go and gone. After the third season, they replaced me. I was devastated. I didn't know what to do. Because I wasn't good with my money, I had to relocate from L.A. to Las Vegas. Eventually, I landed a great gig with Adam Steck and Spy Entertainment at the Excalibur, and Las Vegas saved me. I worked a regular show in Vegas for more than a decade. I learned a lot from that painful period in my life. Do we learn much from the painless periods? Wondering, Louie. That's somebody's baby. Hey, Mom. This past Thursday night, I was coming out of a charity event in Hollywood. As I reached the corner where the car was waiting for me, I noticed a big plastic cup perched in front of a yellow blanket, the kind of blanket we grew up with, fuzzy with silk trim, the type we had on our beds, built forts with, spread out on our lawns on the 4th of July to watch fireworks. Anyway, it took me a moment to realize what I was looking at. At first, it was just a blanket on a sidewalk, but wait, no, it was twisted in such a way that it looked almost like a partial chalk outline of a murder scene, with a pair of footed white tube socks peeking out from one end. Damn. There's a person under there. Motionless. I halted in my tracks and stared at the image, sorrow washing over me. I wanted to see if the person under there was okay, but immediately I thought, what a silly question. He was nowhere close to okay. I dropped some money in the cup and moved on, thinking, that's somebody's son. That's somebody's brother. That's somebody's dad. That's somebody's old friend. Once upon a time, that was somebody's baby. I was shaken, but kept moving, and because I'm a so-called celebrity, and I have means, and I got lucky, soon I was seated in the private comfort of a SUV speeding safely into the night. I stared absently at my bag of leftovers, tasty free-range chicken and lots of it, and thought, damn, why didn't I leave the food for my fellow man under the blanket? Then I thought, well, maybe he's a vegan. I snickered to myself and thought, that's a good bit, a homeless person who's vegetarian or vegan. But really, I was just trying to cover up my sorrow. I snickered a little more. Now I'm thinking of Snickers. It's not the first bit I've thought up or done about homeless people. Once I did a joke about a guy passing me on the street and I'm eating and he says, I haven't eaten in 5 days. And I say, well, you're not getting this. Then I say to the audience, I didn't say it, but I thought it. I did another joke about how I once went 3 hours without eating, but that was because of a bad waiter. Jokes are one way to keep sorrow at bay, because let's be honest, there's no chance the sorrow won't return. Oh, it'll be back. Don't worry. Like the line by Bogey at the end of Casablanca. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. Sometimes the sorrow doesn't even wait till tomorrow to return. I really should try and do something to help the homeless, Mom. Because it would help an individual, it'd help my sorrow, and it's also something you would do. Of course, it's no rare thing to see a homeless person in America. We all see them all the time. Or at least, they're there all the time. I'm not sure most of us see them after a while. And getting to the point of being homeless can really, truly happen to anyone. All of us are sad and confused at so many points in our lives. So many of us have addictions and weaknesses, usually more than one. How do people not have a major addiction or weakness in this world? How is that possible? It doesn't take much to lose your way. It's surprisingly easy. The stories are always harrowing and unbelievable. Then all of a sudden believable. Yeah, I suppose I could see that happening. Yeah, I could definitely see that happening. Yeah, I could see that happening to someone I love. Yeah, I could see that happening to me. It happened to me. A week ago, I passed a strip mall and saw a man outside a 7-Eleven and thought maybe he was going through the garbage bin, but I wasn't sure. It was twilight and hard to see. Isn't twilight the most heartbreaking time to see a homeless person and think about the night that's beginning for them? Isn't twilight the most heartbreaking time to see anything? So at first, I couldn't see if he was recycling or looking for food, and maybe he was mumbling to himself. And then he crossed himself, and I realized his mumbling was him saying the Lord's Prayer. He was about to eat, and he was gathering up the pieces that would make up a godly meal all around him on the top of the trash bin. Some people don't have easy lives. They just don't. I angled into the parking spot near him. I got out of the car and walked over and gave him some cash. There's another bit about the homeless I used to do, about how when we give money to the homeless, we base it partly on how we think they'll spend it. Wow, I do a lot of humor about homelessness. I guess it makes sense. If you grow up in the projects and your father is often jobless and the lights and TV often get shut off because the electricity bill didn't get paid. But who am I? Who is anyone to get judgmental when giving a homeless person money? Because he or she, you know, might buy drugs or liquor with it. Yeah, went my old joke. I didn't think he was going to use the money to open a 401k. Or another joke, maybe he'll buy crack with it because that way, for a few minutes, at least he won't think he's homeless. A lot of us are conditional with our giving. We shouldn't be. Either give or don't give. Right, Mom? Who are we to judge? Listen, I'm going to give you this $20 bill, but this is how I want you to allocate it. Screw you. I remember how we'd get our welfare support in the form of vouchers, not cash. So if we had to buy clothes, we'd pay with vouchers. It was really belittling. Probably not intentionally, but belittling nonetheless. As if they'd given my parents cash. Hey, you never know what we might have done with it. That $50 a month could really lead to something dangerous. We might have started a business on the side. Not quite in twilight, Louie. If there are cheeseheads in Bucharest, blame me. Hey, Mom. Hello, Louie. How are you? I'm writing to ask if you could help me with writing my bachelor's paper because I chose a topic, Thematic Variation in Life with Louie by Louie Anderson. I would like to ask you if you could tell me some useful details about the cartoon that no one else knows and some interesting aspects about you. Because there's not much information on the internet. Your biggest fan, Claudia from Poland. Mom, many Americans know who I am. More older ones than younger ones, and lots of Midwesterners, and especially Minnesotans, know. But want to guess where I'm really popular? Eastern Europe. That's because my animated TV series, Life with Louie, which first ran in America in the 90s, somehow became one of the most popular shows in Poland, Romania, and Turkey. So there's a mini generation of people there who grew up watching it, liking it, and identifying with our family's life. The Andersons, can you believe it? I based the show on my childhood experience, though I made some changes. I moved the setting from Minnesota to Wisconsin, which meant the family were all big Green Bay Packers fans. Not Minnesota Vikings fans. And while the dad was a war vet, like Dad, and his nickname was Andy, like Dad, and he was gruff, he was nowhere near as angry and mean as Dad. I definitely tamed things down. That's TV for you. Lots of details in the show are very similar. The title character, Louis Anderson, is chubby, funny, and sweet like me most of the time. Louis has a kid brother, Tommy, and I gave them 4 older brothers and 4 older sisters, so that's close to accurate. And the mom is Aura Anderson, kind, loving, sweet-natured. Her character was voiced by Edie McClurg, a talented actress and comedian with the perfect Midwestern accent, who played the school secretary in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Recently, while I was performing at a club, Edie was in the audience, and I pointed her out, and the audience went crazy. Mom, she's a cross between you and Mary, with beautiful red hair, a sweet smiling face, and a voice that makes you want to eat pie. She could have fit right into our family. Anyway, Life with Louis ran for 3 seasons and won a couple of Emmy Awards for Outstanding Performer in an Animated Series. But what I'm most proud of is it won the Humanitas Prize for Children's Animation each and every year it ran. The prize is given to stories that affirm the dignity of the human person, probe the meaning of life, and enlighten the use of human freedom. Okay, is that what I'm really most proud of? Or is it Life with Louis branded SpaghettiOs in the shape of various characters from the show? Talk about making it, Mom. I'd carefully eat each of the other characters and push yours to one side, waiting to eat those all together. Now I have hundreds of thousands of Facebook fans from Central and Eastern Europe. I know what Facebook. Remember the bulletin board at the laundromat? Where people posted stuff like, dryer 6 doesn't work. Someone should clean the bathroom. Judy's pregnant. Watch All in the Family this Monday. Who has an apartment for rent? Anyone want a cat? Facebook is like that, except with more judgment. My Life with Louis fans often post pictures of themselves in Packers jerseys or hats waving Packers banners. And I always think, wow, there's nowhere they'd be wearing a cheese hat in Romania except for me. My life, my childhood, the goofy, crazy Andersons at 1122 Hazelwood Apartment A. We caused that. I hope some of the other stuff I was trying to say with Life with Louis also got through. Hi, Louis. I grew up watching the Life with Louis series. Just love the way your mother raised you and treated you the right way in the toughest situations. Let me mention some of the stories I remember even now about her as I've seen them in the series, even though it's been almost 20 years since the series aired in Romania. The story about her becoming the baseball coach for your team. Mother's Day when she got sick and you took care of her. When she won the award for cooking at the fair. When she was against you working over the summer at the golf club and you got more money than the family had in a month. When you got the first stand-up in your dining room after meeting the great Kazoo. When you went camping with the classmates and she sent you extra underwear and cookies. When she got herself a job selling perfume and makeup for money when your father got fired. When her mother died and you searched for a specific place that grandma went because you forgot to thank her for all the winter blouses. The most emotional episode ever. When she prepared Thanksgiving dinner for all your family and relatives. Your father had a fight with her brother. I hope that story had a happy ending. I don't know if all these stories are true, but I just love your mother for her mind, her soul, her beauty in every way. Best regards, Mirela Maria from Romania. Anyway, sorry fictionalized Wisconsinite Andersons, but go Vikings! Animatedly Louie. Who, me? Hey, Mom. To be or not to be, that is not the question. No, the question is, could you please get off your butt and pick up the remote control I dropped and slip it back into my hand? Thank you. Okay, that's not the question either. No, the question is, who? Who's going to save me? Isn't that the question we all ask ourselves, silently all the time, whether we're religious or not? Who? Everything else is minor by comparison. What's for dinner? Where's the nearest gas station? When's my favorite TV show on? Nah, it's who will save me in life and who will comfort me, and isn't it true that there isn't one person, or actually there is, because it's really just me that has to decide that I'm enough and that I can take care of myself and that I can comfort myself. And that's why this morning, when I was at the coffee house and I got my coffee, light, of course, because you and I put so much milk in our coffee, it's almost albino, I did not get the cookies, which came in six evil choices. Peanut butter, chocolate chunk, peanut chunky, snickerdoodle, pumpkin chocolate chunky cheese, and plain old sugar. Are they trying to kill me? I was the one being confronted. It was up to me to save myself, no one else. I got out of there by the skin of my teeth. Who is what it's all about? You gonna eat that, Louie? Who, me? Other people come in and out of your life, but the real truth is that we have to find peace in ourselves when we look into the mirror. We have to come to the idea that that's enough, that we're enough, that we can survive, that we can be fearless, that we can go forward, that we can find our way, even when sometimes there doesn't seem to be a way to find. In the end, the how doesn't matter that much, does it? If it works, it works. The where doesn't matter either, though it's fun to wonder about. Will it happen as I lie in bed in my home, while traveling in another country, while sitting in a chair, while I'm at the state fair? The what we know. So it's really who and when. And the who is us, a new version of us. So it's really one question, but a different one from the start. When will we be saved? Now? Later? Never? Today's as good a time as any. Saving myself, Louie. I am Christine. Hey, Mom. Playing Christine Baskets has helped me appreciate you in new ways. Like the restraint and the optimism and the stress and the care you expressed and endured every day of our lives. Every day of your marriage. Every day of your life as mom of so many children. Christine is so aware of her faults and also of her strengths. And you were like that too. I want to think that I'm like that, but maybe that's for others to say, not me. Jonathan Kreisel, our brilliant director, said about Christine, "You feel for her and the family she was dealt." Is that how you felt, Mom, I wonder? It sounds as if that could be true of you, though you probably would have never put it that way. When the show finally airs, I think people are going to love the character. I hope they'll relate to her because they will see in her their own mom or other moms they've been around. Mothers are artists in their way, wouldn't you say? They're like symphony conductors of entire lives. They're painters and sculptors. And not only is it really hard to shape clay into something really good, but that piece of clay is changing dramatically all the time, even if you never touch it. A painting won't get painted if you just leave the canvas alone, but a child will still develop into something even if you neglect it. Each mom and dad have to adapt to what they're trying to make, hoping to make. And mom and dad also have to let the child turn into the creation he or she wants to be. Oh, and then lots of moms and dads have to do this with two or three separate creations simultaneously. Or, in the case of you or Azella Anderson, with 11 creations. How is that not way more impressive than anything a great painter does? Picasso Schmacasso! 11 masterpieces, Mom. That's what you made. You made them with love, care, and kindness. You gave them everything you had. You squeezed every ounce of paint out of the paint tube. Used every bristle on the brush to make our lives more beautiful, more visual. You gave us depth, you gave us color, you gave us foreshadowing and texture. And Mom, sometimes I think you didn't leave enough paint in the tube to complete the masterpiece that was you. Jonathan also said of Christine, movies and TV aren't usually about these type of women. Someone who's gained a lot of weight and had a family and it didn't turn out that great. That's another reason that people are going to fall in love with the character, I think. She's so real. She looks like so many people we all know. She's built like so many people we all know. And if people don't know a bunch of middle-aged or older women and moms who look like Christine and who are built like Christine, those people really need to look in the mirror and figure out what choices they've made in their lives to deprive themselves of that. They should head downtown to any city anywhere in America right now and just sit on a bench, open their eyes. They won't have to wait more than 10 minutes before Christine walks by. Probably more like 2 minutes. Here's Jonathan again. There's so much annoying shit that people have to do just to get through their day. It's a struggle. You have to think, do I have my medicine? Do I have my stuff? People get excited about their cell phone plans, too. They get excited about getting a deal. And Christine is that kind of person. She gets excited about deals. She's got a garage full of stuff. Maybe it's an American thing. Mom, you love the deal. The 88 cent store. The 99 cent store. 2-for-1s. Look at these, Louie. 2-for-1. 3-for-1. It didn't matter if it was crap. You loved anything that was marked down. Don't we all? If you'd have found something that used to be $700 and now it's a quarter, even though we didn't want it or need it, you would have been in heaven. But you are. Never mind. I love Christine. Maybe she's quintessentially American. I love that she can say, I'm in between sizes right now. Mom, the show has amazing writers. But if I'm being completely honest, since I'm the one playing Christine and dressed up as her, every now and then, on set, often in the middle of shooting the scene, I'll tell Jonathan or the writers what I think Christine should say and how I think she should react, and they let me, because they know it's right. Jonathan and the writers don't mind. Their ideas are there in every scene. So as long as we keep the basic content intact, it's fine. I just want to put a little bit more of Orizella Prouty, Orizella Anderson, Louis P. Anderson, and maybe even a little Louis W. Anderson in there, too, along with the helping of Mary, Rhea, Sheila, Shanna, and Lisa Anderson. You know what I wonder? When I think of you as I play Christine, which age and stage of you am I channeling? Is it you as an older woman, nearing the end of your life? You when I was just a little boy? You when I was a young man? You as I think you were before I was born? Are those yous very different? I think I'm playing you as a whole, Mom. And think what an advantage I have. Not only am I 62, but you were 77 when you died, so that's 139 years of experience. Could I possibly have added that right? Yes, I did. 139 years to draw on. I think people will respond to Christine because she represents a kind of reverse cool. She's so obviously her own person, doing things on her terms, whether it's bargain shopping at Costco or baking or house cleaning or trying to clean up some mess her sons keep making. I've given Christine an energy, a feistiness that I hope viewers will respond to. She's trying to take control of things. After all the heartache she's suffered, and at this point in her life, how can she possibly have energy to do that? How is she not too exhausted by the very thought of that? How? Because that's you. That's what you were like. That's how your humanity, your empathy, were big enough to form the sixth great lake. The best thing about Christine's character, Mom, she gets to twirl. And I don't mean twirl her hair, and I don't mean dance. I mean she gets to be alive. The show premieres in late January. I have a bunch of Baskets Media coming up. I'll write soon. You live in me and with me every day. Louis. My First Lady. Hey, Mom, it's me again. I'm not ready to discuss the day you left this crazy world. I don't know if I ever will be. But I want to talk to you about the time I took you to the White House in 1986 to meet President Reagan and the First Lady. I still think about the experience now and then because it was a joyous event for me as an entertainer and a low point for me as a son. We were there as part of an all-star salute commemorating the reopening of Ford's Theater, where John Wilkes Booth shot and killed President Lincoln. That part of the festivities was bittersweet, too. The renovation was beautiful. But in the museum, in the downstairs of the theater, there were all sorts of artifacts of the tragedy, including the actual bloody sheets, more than a century old, from Abraham Lincoln's dying body. The entertainment was Lance Burton, Victor Borga, Joel Grey, Freddie Roman, Jacqueline Smith, Tommy Toon, and me. It was going to be a TV special, taped, not live. We all performed for the President and First Lady, then went to the White House to meet them. Ron and Nancy. Christine Baskets is a huge Ronald Reagan fan. Not bad for a kid from the St. Paul Projects, right? Mom, I'm writing this letter about a very specific occasion that happened 3 decades ago. Because I was not a very good son that night. I was mean to you. Yes, mean. Yes, me. I thought what you were wearing wasn't up to the White House standards. But my opinion was a bunch of crap. It wasn't true. Want to know the sad thing? The dress you wore was just like one that Christine wears. A sundress, in fact, a quite beautiful one. It was absolutely up to standards. I was being a jerk. Why, I don't know. I still think about my mean-spirited, childish behavior that night. Why would I be cruel? Because someone was cruel to me? And when someone is cruel to you, the cruelty has to go somewhere. If the cruelty happens to you when you're a child, a developing person, the cruelty gets in there, does all kinds of damage, like a ricocheting bullet, keeps ricocheting around in there. And if you don't deal with it, if it isn't addressed and resolved, if you can't figure out why the cruel person is being that way to you, it'll cause you lingering resentments that just keep ricocheting. So, Mom, that resentment came from someplace deep inside me, and I'm sorry that it got out, because you didn't deserve that ricochet hurting you. I wish I had a less disappointing explanation for my actions. But even with an explanation, I still wondered why I would ever hurt you, the sweetest person I'd ever known, the best mother ever. I can't undo how I acted then. I can only say I'm so sorry for being cruel to you, for the stupidity and carelessness of it. To this day, it breaks my heart because I'm sure it broke yours. The best thing is, I know deep in my heart that you forgave me. If you could forgive Dad, then you could do it with me for that. Mom, I had the bullet removed, finally. The resentment of Dad, the resentment is gone. And I know I've done some kind things for you. I know that because Jimmy told me when you were a young mother, before I was born, you'd say things like, someday I'm going to go to Europe, and I'm going to have this, and I'm going to do that. And he would say, it's never going to happen, Ma. Though he told me that he felt really bad afterwards, that he had dismissed your dreams like that. And with each kid added, the chances of you doing even one of those things got smaller and smaller, then tiny, then it looked like they disappeared altogether. And then, in the late 80s, I took you to England, and we had lunch in Paris. I bought you a nice car, I took you to the White House, and at least some of those experiences and possessions you had always wished for happened. I'm glad I could do that. Still, please accept my sincere apology for my senseless behavior. Mom, you were, and always will be, my First Lady. Your regretful, careless, and occasionally even cruel 10th child.
Louis.
Thank you, brother. Hey, Tommy. Thanks for helping Shanna and for all you do for me and everyone in our family. What you did for Mom, Billy, and Sheila, thanks for thinking about me. I can't wait to see you when I'm back in town for New Year's Eve, and also when you visit me again. Life is short and we should cherish each other all the time. And, like you, be willing to help. Miss you, love you, Truth Ranger, a.k.a. my brother Thomas Todd Anderson. Love, Brother Louis. Truth Ranger. Hey, Mom, I've been texting a lot with Tommy since we live far apart. I love texting because it's a great way to send a really quick message to someone, which they usually see pretty quickly, if not immediately. It doesn't take the time of a phone call, and it doesn't demand the other person be available when you send the message. It has an intimacy. I love that Tommy and I can communicate in this way, especially since I'm in Las Vegas or Los Angeles or traveling, and he's in Newport, Minnesota, just a few miles down the Mississippi from where we grew up in East St. Paul, and it's too rare that we get a chance to be in the same place together. But I try. We try. I loved and love all my brothers and sisters, but Tommy and I are 2 years apart. He's been my best buddy, the sibling I'm closest to, the baby of the family, number 11 of 11. He and I are two peas in a pod, as Laurel and Hardy used to say. You know all this, Mom. He's funny and he loves to tinker and he's impatient and he rolls his own cigarettes and he's a hoarder, like us, and so generous and really smart and such a good friend, and he's bipolar and a little paranoid. And I used to tiny talk with him when I was mad at him because he was the only sibling who was younger than I was and who I could sort of bully. And later, I made that part of one of my routines. He will always be my baby brother. I've given him at least 200 tiny bottles of shampoo that I've taken from hotel rooms. He was so sweet and good to move back to the Twin Cities to help with our sisters. The last couple of years, Tommy's been signing most of his texts to me with Truth Ranger. He came up with the idea for a children's show called Truth Rangers, which would encourage kids to always tell the truth. There'd be some adventure, and the outcome would be a lesson about truth or lying or just life. He always puts the phrase in quotation marks, though he's used it so often at this point he could just drop them. Nobody's going to sue. He'll text me anything. That's what texting does for you, Mom. Anything and everything seems worth sharing. A few examples from Tommy to me. Stay away from the dollar store. You won't be able to stop yourself. Ha ha. My neighbor Kelly knocked over the computer monitor / TV, which was held up by a gallon of enamel paint. Have to perform brain surgery on myself. Just need one more mirror. Truth Ranger. I think it's the little things, at least as much as the big things, maybe even more than the big things, that remind me to be present and grateful. I love having a younger brother. Love, lucky older brother Louis, a.k.a. Truth Ranger's sidekick. New Year's Eve, minus the booze. Hey, Mom. Tonight's New Year's Eve 2015, almost 2016. And for each of the last 25 years, I've hosted a special kind of New Year's Eve bash. Now we do it at the Ames Center in Burnsville. Before that, it was at Northrop Auditorium on the University of Minnesota campus. So what makes it special? Starting the year after you died, I decided to begin each new year honoring you. How? By having no alcohol served at the venue where I perform. Because we grew up with a father who always drank and who made us live in fear of his drunken behavior. And of all of us, you had to deal with it most of all. So I wanted one night. In fact, the night most associated with alcohol consumption. When people who don't want liquor in their lives could go someplace, have a great celebration, and not worry about drinking or being around people who are drunk. the Minnesotans and tourists who come seem to really love it. My goal tonight, like every time I perform, but especially tonight, is to make people feel as if they are going to pee from laughing so hard.